Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Remember that chilling video of a petite black girl wearing a bikini at a pool party in McKinney, Texas, who was violently held on the ground by the weight of an officer? The video went viral last year. It showed Corporal Eric Casebolt grabbing 15-year-old Digeria Becton by her arm and slamming her to the ground. She tried to get up, but Casebolt held her to the ground by putting both of his knees on her back. He then pulled out his gun as he was surrounded by a crowd trying to help Digeria Becton. Casebolt eventually resigned. The video sparked a major public outcry and further scrutiny of law enforcement's seemingly default response to black youth. Now, these incidents are all too common, but most of them are not caught on video, especially when girls are involved. In her new book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, today's guest, Dr. Monique Morris, writes, quote, "A growing number of cases have surfaced to reveal what many of us have known for centuries. Black girls are directly impacted by criminalizing policies and practices that render them vulnerable to abuse, exploitation, dehumanization, and under the worst circumstances, death." End quote. Monique Morris details the policies and the practices that have led to unhealthy and unsafe learning environments. The institutions that are supposed to educate, provide opportunities, and support black girls are often where they feel judged and degraded. As alarming as these incidents are, and she tells so many of them in her book, Monique Morris believes that we can fix this. She advocates for the free expression on black femininity and for a school system that allows black girls to live with dignity and respect. Monique Morris has been working in the areas of education, civil rights, and social justice for more than 20 years. She is co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. She's author of Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 25th Century. Her debut novel, Too Beautiful for Words, is a favorite among young girls in detention facilities and marginalized youth across the country. And Monique joins me in studio. Hi, Monique. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So I understand that you're also going to travel to Washington, D.C. next week for a congressional briefing on your book.
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's huge news.
It is great to have that level of interest and to be able to center discussions about school pushout and black girls, and also to discuss with policymakers some of the potential interventions that we might consider.
Because you make a great point in your book. While the media have spent so much time focusing on these issues, most of the focus is on black boys. In fact, I was thinking about the series we did last year about all of these issues, and we rarely talked about girls.
Yeah, it's typically, you know, for about 10 years at least, there have been a handful of us who have been in meetings and discussions about criminal and juvenile legal system reform and various discussions about developing racial and justice reform agendas. And, you know, we have been the lone voices in many spaces asking the question, what about the girls? What about the women? And there's been a growing number of, you know, efforts led largely by the African American Policy Forum and other organizations with, online or media campaigns like Say Her Name, you know, that really try to bring in women and girls in a way that is substantial. But I think we're just now moving to a space where folks are beginning to understand that girls and women, you know, share many of the punitive spaces with the boys and men in their lives and in their communities. And so if we're going to actually talk about building a robust reform agenda, we have to look at people along the gender continuum.
And you point out in your book, after the fatal shooting of Tamir Rice, the officers tackled his 14-year-old sister
exactly.
to the ground and handcuffed her. Not only had she just watched her little brother die at the hands of these officers, but she was forced to grieve his death from the back seat of a police car.
That's right. And this invisibility is what I'm seeking to challenge and, you know, really remove from our practices with Push Out. I wanted to really bring to the fore the narratives of women and girls who have had their pain rendered as secondary, you know, to the pain of the men and boys in our communities. And I don't think it's been explicit, you know, when I have these, I don't think it's been intentional, I should say, although some argue that it is in some ways. I think more so it's a manifestation of how we've come to define the issues and the frameworks that we're using to explore which lives matter and, you know, how we'll respond to that. And so, you know, when we talk even about the school-to-prison pipeline or the, you know, the activities in schools that facilitate the criminalization of youth, it's often presented as a very linear process where there's a citation or arrest on campus that leads to future contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems. But one of the things that I argue and push out and in my, you know, sort of greater body of research is that really, when we're talking about girls, we have to explore the multiple pathways that facilitate criminalization. We have to look at the policies, the practices, and the prevailing consciousness that allows for this level of criminalization or marginalization to occur. And so when we broaden the scope and we talk about more than just acts of violence that are shaped by gunshots, mm-hmm. right, or shaped by visible death in street, as painful and harmful as those situations are, that is not the extent to which our communities are impacted by violence and victimization. And so it's important for us to really cast a wider lens and a broader scope in our inquiry so that we can respond to it all.
You tell so many unbelievable stories, but before we talk about those, you write that Black girls are 16% of the female student population, so 16% of the female student population, but nearly one-third of all girls refer to law enforcement and more than one-third of all female school-based arrests.
Yes, and, you know, 42% of girls who are experiencing corporal punishment, almost half of the girls experiencing in-school and out-of-school suspensions, 42% of girls who have received expulsion with or without educational services. So there's a consistent overrepresentation. In fact, Black girls are the only group of girls that are overrepresented in all categories for which data are collected by the U.S. Department of Education on discipline issues. And those statistics, you know, for me, are very alarming. And so I wanted to dig a little deeper, right? We hear the statistics and we understand that this disparity exists, but one of the reasons why we measure and engage this question of disparity is so that we can understand what's producing it.
Right.
And to maybe peel back a few of the layers that help us understand whether it's a function of differential treatment, whether it's about discrimination, or whether it's about something else.
So before we talk about how is it possible that a six-year-old can be handcuffed and arrested for throwing a tantrum in her kindergarten class, for people who aren't aware of no tolerance policies, they didn't have those when I was in school. Can you explain what they are?
Zero tolerance policies are a set of policies and sort of a portfolio of punitive responses to student behaviors in schools that basically require schools to suspend or produce automatically a suspension or expulsion based upon specific acts. What it does is it removes the personal decision-making capacity of the administrators on campus to be able to respond to a situation based upon the actual events that took place in that particular instance. And so with zero tolerance policies, often what's missing is a discussion about some of the factors that led up to the incident, some of the special considerations that might be a part of how we come to understand what happened, and all you get is, you know, sort of cut and dry responses to situations that are hardly cut and dry. So you'll see kids who show up on school, for example, with a butter knife to cut a sandwich, and because they have a, quote, knife on campus, it's perceived as them having a weapon. Or you'll get cases where kids are fighting, but in some cases, particularly girls, and some of these narratives I include in the book, are fighting in response to being bullied, and a lot of that bullying emerging from their own victimization that they're responding to that was not caught by the school, but their fighting was caught by the school. And so it doesn't allow for us to fully explore the conditions that underlie the activity. It only focuses on the activity.
And I was surprised to read in your book, Push Out, that when it comes to these no-tolerance policies, people who often know little to nothing about child or adolescent development and who often lack the appropriate awareness and training for the school environments they patrol are responding to behaviors that were previously managed by skilled teachers, counselors, principals, and other professionals.
Well, that's right.
So who's implementing these policies?
So educators, administrators are often implementing the policies. But what's also happened, which I talk about in the book, is that there's been an increase in the number of school-based law enforcement officers, agents, various instruments of surveillance is what I call them, the metal detectors, the security videos. And what we've done is we've created a learning space in many of our communities that is hyper-punitive and that resembles in many ways priming young people for a life of institutionalization. And that to me is highly problematic. And it also, you know, presents us with a unique opportunity to explore what we're doing, right? What we're doing and how we want to teach young people to maintain safety in their own spaces and to partner with adults to create that. One of the things that I often say is that safety is not something that can be implemented with these instruments, right, or these individuals. Safety is a concept that's co-constructed between individuals. And so when we don't engage young people, particularly girls in this case, in discussions about how to facilitate their own safety, then we are not truly responding to, the call to action here around maintaining safety in schools.
And where is this happening mostly?
What do you mean? Where?
In terms of no tolerance policies and these check bags you have to get checked before you can get into the school.
Yeah.
Where is this happening?
So this book talks about this issue nationwide. And while California specifically has, legislation that encourages schools to exhaust all remedy before they engage in exclusionary discipline practices, what we found is that in our exploration of how zero tolerance policies are implemented is that they really are happening largely in high poverty, low-performing districts, school districts, and schools. And so, I have gone to very rigorous schools where we did not have people patrolling the hallways, where there was discussion about safety, where there was an expectation that we would participate in the co-construction of our safety. And then I've gone into schools where that is absolutely not the norm, and there's been no climate to fully engage and establish that as a norm. And so, I largely think that, much of how we've constructed policies around discipline and safety have to do with our deep-seated ideas about who needs and requires discipline and who is deserving of other interventions or a continuum of responses to, abhorrent student behavior or when a kid makes a mistake in class or in schools, as children will do, how we respond to that.
You, in the summer of 2014, you met with young women in Chicago, high school age or just above, to talk about some of their experiences in these schools. And one of the girls, Michelle, who graduated in 2010, said she felt like they were always being watched as if we were going to do something. She felt like it was favoritism with people in the schools, especially coming from the security guards. The same actions would take place, but different people would get different consequences.
Right.
And the whole police station in the school, it wasn't the space for that, and I just didn't understand why they would put something like that in place.
Right. Many girls are grappling with this idea of having police stations in their schools. And while they are also concerned about their own personal physical and emotional safety in schools, given some of the activities that I also describe in the book about their increased risk of sexual victimization on campus that goes largely unaddressed, and harassment that goes largely unaddressed, they are more concerned about really the response being inadequate and in many ways facilitating or exacerbating the problem. They don't feel safer with these things in place. In fact, some of the girls in Chicago described, in that segment that you just read from, they describe the embarrassment that they feel when they have to engage with male police officers around, going through security, pat downs in some cases, or the investigation into their bags when they have personal hygiene, products in there. And for teenage girls, that can be very, very mortifying. And there just hasn't been a lot of discussion. And I say in the book that much of the way in which we implemented policy was in response to a very masculinized way of understanding violence and victimization. And so because these girls were not at the center of our exploration around how we can co-construct safety, how we come to understand and define violence and risk, that they have been living with the same level of surveillance that produces this criminalizing context, but the responses haven't factored in the ways in which they are uniquely impacted by it all.
Right.
So
I can't imagine if a young girl is maybe looked at in a strange way by one of these officers and then has to see him every day on her way to school.
Yeah, some of the girls, I mean, and it's not just the officers. I'm in a project now with my organization, the National Black Women's Justice Institute. We have a partnership with Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality, and we're looking at the relationship between school resource officers and girls of color, largely to examine some of the protocols and training curriculum that officers usually don't get with respect to how to engage in a culturally competent and gender responsive way. The conversations about how we engage with youth has largely been about how we engage with male youth. And so the responses to girls, cis and transgender, have been woefully inadequate and often stigmatizing in ways that exacerbate school pushout.
You report that over time, the number of these school resource officers has grown tremendously. In 2007, there were 6,700 more of these officers than in 1997. So as this issue is starting to get a little more traction, are these organizations open to having training and to hearing what people like you have to say?
I believe so. I think it's different in various communities. Justice, like education, is a very local entity. And so there have been, for the most part, a very favorable response from school resource officers around the country who want to better understand how their practices might be improved with and engagement with girls of color improved. But really what we're seeking to attack, I think both in my book and also in the work that we do ongoing, is the element of this that's facilitated by our misreading and lack of understanding about expressions of femininity by black girls and black young women, and some of the latent ideas that all of us are living with, the implicit biases that we're living with that facilitate how we read their volume, how we understand physical expression, and how we police their bodies in the name of, sort of implementing respectful engagement and clothing. and so I think there is really a lot more for us to explore because, we like to think about school resource officers as being the problem, and I think there is definitely an issue to explore there. But really, a lot of what I spend time talking about in Push Out and in this work around school push out is the way in which all of us, the educators, parents, community, have constructed a public gaze that is really misinformed when it comes to black girls and does not engage in meaningful ways this history of victimization and violence that black girls uniquely experience or disproportionately experience, that does also play a role in how they come to confront and engage in their own learning.
We're speaking today with Monique Morris about her new book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. She writes that a growing number of cases have surfaced to reveal what many of us have known for centuries. Black girls are directly impacted by criminalizing policies and practices that render them vulnerable to exploitation and dehumanization. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you are a black girl, student, parent, teacher, administrator, what are your thoughts on this issue? We spend so much time talking about black boys, but not much time talking about black girls. So if you have any stories you'd like to experience about what you see, what challenges you see, what issues are playing out, or if you've got a daughter or a son in school who goes to school with black girls, what stands out for you? What do you see in that school? What concerns you about this? And if you're a teacher or administrator, what do you think about these no tolerance policies? The toll-free number is 866.
This is a rebroadcast of a previously aired program. We're not taking calls right now. Thank you.
You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Tell us more about the word push out and where that comes from.
Yeah, push out emerged as a term to counter the dominant labeling of children who fail to complete school as dropouts. And what it does is it shifts our thinking a bit about not placing the sort of blame, if you will, on young people who have not been able to complete school, but rather explore the structural and sort of systemic processes that provide opportunities and, in fact, in some ways incentivize young people not to complete school. So push out is really, what started as a very intentional way to bring attention to the school discipline practices that physically remove children from school, and high-stakes testing that discourage children from completing school in some ways. You know, push-out emerged as a term that provides, I think, a greater opportunity for us to explore the dynamic nature of why it is that young people are not completing school. When I talk about school push-out in the book, I talk not only about these testing scenarios and discipline scenarios that can facilitate a marginalization or push-out of Black girls. I also talk about the role of victimization and violence in their lives in and, you know, on and off campus, as well as this, you know, particular risk that many girls, disproportionately Black girls, face when they are commercially sexually exploited and pulled out of school.
We talk often about at-risk programs. Are there many at-risk programs for girls, Black girls,
well,
especially?
So I like to use the term high-risk or, you know, vulnerable youth, because I think anyone can be at risk,
right?
And, you know, I think particularly in our communities, there has not been the same level of investment in programming in response to girls who are at high risk of school push out or who have experienced violence and victimization in school or out of school that can facilitate them not completing school.
Are there any programs out there that you think need to be emulated?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of growing programs. And in fact, in the back of the book, I include a list of programs that are serving Black girls. There are a group of stellar programs, you know, back east in the Bay Area, emerging programs and strategies that are looking at Black girls and other girls of color. The Alliance for Girls is a Bay Area collective that has, I believe, you know, more than 70 girl-serving institutions now that are a part of it that are specifically focused on, you know, developing freedom for girls and spaces of learning for girls. Black girl programs are fewer, you know, than the programs, you know, or those programs that are designed to specifically address the cultural and you know, sort of gender-responsive nature and needs of programming for Black girls are not as widespread as they are for boys. And a lot of that has been because they're, you know, we are now entering, you know, almost a decade of organizing and critical foundation investment in the well-being of Black boys and young men. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote Push Out is that I hope that by sharing some of the narratives of the girls and helping us better understand what their pathways to delinquency have been and what role the schools have played in this, can help us structure a more robust engagement and investment in their well-being and needs as we move forward.
After the break, we will talk about some of these stories. There are so many stories in Monique Morris's new book, Push Out. We'll talk about why six-year-olds are being handcuffed and arrested in Florida for throwing tantrums in kindergarten class. Monique Morris is author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions or comments do you have about this? The issue of criminalizing Black youth is getting so much more attention in the media, but most of the focus is on Black boys. We're not hearing as much about Black girls, even though they too are directly impacted. And if you have any personal stories you'd like to share about what's happening at your school or with your children or maybe with you when you were in school, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
And we'll return to this conversation that Rose had with Monique Morris in just a moment after we thank people who have been helping us push toward our goal for our September campaign here at KALW. We are now down to $27,000 to go, thanks to generous listeners like Douglas Debs in Palo Alto, Chris Nichols in San Francisco, and Wendell Chu, also here in the city.
Other people who've gone online at KALW.org to help us out include Richard Rollins of Portola Valley, Fiona Harding of Mountain View, and Susan Hampton of El Cerrito. Thank you so much for coming through for us.
Every single one of them making a difference. Please join them at KALW.org.
And thank you.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Monique Morris. She is out with a new book called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Black girls are 16% of the female student population, but nearly one-third of all girls referred to law enforcement. Monique Morris says we need to spend more time talking about black girls. She's been working in the areas of education, civil rights, and social justice for more than 20 years. She's author of Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century. Her debut novel, Too Beautiful for Words, is a favorite among young girls in detention facilities and marginalized youth across the country. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255.
This is a rebroadcast of a program that's aired before. We are not taking calls this morning. Thank you.
So many disturbing stories. I had to read a few of these a couple times because it's just really hard to believe. Just a couple. In May 2013, Ashley Ann Avery, a 16-year-old diabetic girl in Alabama, fell asleep while reading Huckleberry Finn during her in-school suspension. When she didn't respond, the suspension supervisor allegedly threw a book at her and ordered her to leave the classroom. As she was leaving, a police officer allegedly slammed her face into a file cabinet and then arrested her. The other one that really gets me is in 2007, 6-year-old Desiree Watson was handcuffed and arrested at her Florida school for throwing a tantrum in her kindergarten class. How common is this?
Well, just a few weeks ago, a 6-year-old in Chicago was placed in handcuffs and placed under the stairs for taking candy from her teacher's desk because he thought that's how he could teach her a lesson, right? And in February, when Black girls, it's Black History Month, and they showed up in school in North Carolina with geles or head wraps on to celebrate their African heritage, and they were told they were violating the school dress code and threatened with suspension. These are the kinds of stories that have typically not surfaced in our media and not really resonated in our consciousness as being a part of school pushout, right? Again, it's how we've come to understand and frame some of these issues and how we've come to understand risk that determines whether or not we see girls. When I talk and lead trainings on this issue, you know, one of the first questions I ask people to engage or participants to engage is, do we see them? And when we see them, what do we see? Right. And that's something that I think it calls all of us to really think through our own, you know, implicit associations mm-hmm. and assumptions about what girls are dealing with and how they're being received and engaged in schools. Certainly, we know 6-year-olds have tantrums.
Right.
Anyone who's seen a 6-year-old knows that they will have a massive tantrum on the floor. How we read that as an assessment of threat to the public safety of a classroom or an adult is another question. And so much of what I am doing in sharing these narratives is, you know, finally sort of putting them together in a way that can help us understand that these might be taking place in different communities, and I try to draw from as many different, you know, locations as possible, but they're presenting us with a broader narrative about how we're misreading the behaviors of black girls and how black girls have been uniquely impacted by a very punitive, response to their behaviors and responding in ways that is inconsistent with how we respond to the behaviors of other girls who exhibit similar behavioral, mm-hmm. Manifestations of their, you know, frustration or dislike for something. And so that's the piece, you know, that I want us to begin to understand is that when we're looking at, again, these disparities, the statistics that, you know, we were talking about earlier, that this is not just because black girls are bad girls, right? This is not a function of black girls, you know, engaging in worse behavior than their white counterparts, right? It's about how we come to understand what black girls are saying when they say something or how we respond to them in ways that are far more punitive than other girls who also make mistakes.
Because this issue doesn't get much attention, you have story after story. How are you able to find these?
So I have been in the advocacy world for several years. And for many of us, you know, we hear these stories all the time. Black newspapers capture many of them. Mm. Other narratives and in community on social media certainly share them. And it's about, you know, whether we're listening, right? Or when we hear these cases, do we keep flicking through as if they don't matter, or do we stop and actually read the story and come to understand what's happening in those communities? You know, like I said, when we're talking about violent victimization and we're talking about frameworks and structures of inequality, we tend to masculinize it by saying, you know, who has been harmed publicly. There are rallies and marches in response to cases and stories of boys being harmed, which is how it, you know, elevates in our consciousness and how it elevates in our social and you know, traditional media outlets. But we don't engage the same level of response when we're talking about similar situations that happen with girls. And we come to define risk and threat really in a way that is rooted, deeply rooted in our patriarchal understandings about how people live with violence. And, you know, I talk a lot about sexual victimization in this book because, again, when we look at the increased rates at which Black girls, and I will add, this book is about Black girls, but, you know, Native American girls and Latina, you know, girls are also experiencing these increased rates of sexual victimization that also render them subject to school pushout. But I wanted to situate this conversation in a particular cultural context. But that is one of the reasons why my broader work with the National Black Women's Justice Institute is about girls of color,
right?
Because I think it's important for us to understand the ways in which sexual victimization plays a role in whether a girl is going to get in trouble with the law. And so when we talk about these issues and we talk about the pathways to delinquency for girls, we cannot ignore that violence doesn't look necessarily like someone getting shot in the street for girls. It can and has, but it doesn't typically look like that. It looks a lot like girls being sexually victimized, then being in contact with someone who can also place them at risk of participation in underground economies, which we know exist in our communities. And that then makes them vulnerable to contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems. And our inability to really look at this centrality of trauma, look at the centrality of victimization, really prevents us from engaging in a rigorous examination of what our girls need.
So speaking of that issue, you tell a story in the beginning of the book about Denisha, and you have met many Denishas in and out of detention facilities. So tell us about Denisha. She's 11 years old.
Yeah. So I met Denisha about 15 years ago. I wrote a street novel called Too Beautiful for Words. And the novel was based on a song by a Bay Area rap group called The Coup. Or the book is based on a song by The Coup. And in writing the book, I sort of spent years as a researcher and engaging in, you know, academic engagements with, you know, girls, boys, in and out of detention facilities. And this was one of the first times that I was able to come back as an author, which, you know, allowed me to, I say, shed my research posture, right, my researcher posture, and really just be myself as an author and talk to the population that had been assembled. I went to this particular facility to talk to a group of girls, and Denisha was one of those girls. And she was 11 years old, and in the context of my talking about this street novel, which talks about prostitution. It's a book that is, it's a novel that explores prostitution in the Bay Area and various ideas associated with liberation. And in the context of talking about that, she identified herself as 11 years old and called herself a hoe. And it really shook me because this is before we accepted that there's no such thing as a child prostitute. Publicly, right? We were still referring to young children as prostitutes. This is before we came to understand that these children were being commercially sexually exploited and had language and interventions that would be responsive to that framework. And that she was 11 years old and described herself in that way, I think will never leave me. And it was jarring because much of what I saw when I saw her was a desire to learn. And instantly I was thinking of her as a fifth grader, right? I look at this girl and I see her and I'm thinking she should be saying, I'm talking about my science experiment, or let me tell you about my teacher, or this is what I'm going through with my friends. And yet she was talking about this heinous act that had been committed against her. And I found her in a detention facility. So we had criminalized her trauma and victimization to the extent that she was locked up. The person exploiting her was not. And all the people who participated in that exploitation were likely not. And so for me, she represents a lot of what's wrong with our interventions and understandings about the particular risk that girls face, but also the ways in which we have we've been complicit in allowing these constructs to continue that place our girls at risk. In that same, you know, discussion about Denisha and her story as a girl, a very young girl who was being commercially sexually exploited, I asked the question about how we come to prime black girls for their own victimization. From the moment they can play patty cake and sing nursery rhymes, I remember singing songs at 5 and 6 years old that were preparing me for a life of victimization, of selling quote-unquote fruit cocktail, or of having pain because my baby's black, or, you know, songs that are not just sung in the Bay Area where I was raised. I was born and raised in San Francisco, right? I mean, I was singing them. But when I encounter women across the country, I start the rhyme, they finish it. People know these rhymes, and it's indoctrinated into the psyche in a way that does not allow us to critically interrogate what our pain looks like and how we interrupt it.
Can you explain fruit cocktail?
So there's at the end of a patty cake, rhyme for Rockin' Robin, there is a piece that is tacked onto the end. And in the end, it says, Mama's in the kitchen burning rice, Daddy's outside shooting dice, Brother's in jail raising hell, Sister's on the corner selling fruit cocktail. And it doesn't matter where I go, I can say, Sister's on the corner selling, and people jump right in and they know exactly what should complete that. And for me, you know, that raises critical questions. I was thrilled when I found out that my own two daughters did not know that song. That the first time they heard that song was when they heard me give a lecture about it, right? I hope that song dies. I want it to disappear. Because how we come to accept that ways to circumvent poverty are an expectation for brother, you know, being in jail and sister on the corner, really, when you're thinking of a young child who's absorbing these ideas about what their trajectory is, you know, that's a very, very problematic, to say the least, construct for right. them to be engaging in. And that we continue to do that without interrogation is something that I want us to interrupt.
What are you hearing from educators about this? Because I don't want to make assumptions about the girls you write about. I'm just thinking about experiences of friends who are teachers.
Yeah.
They are dealing with kids who are coming from impoverished families,
sure.
moms who don't know if they're going to make the rent. They are, you know, eating food that makes them fly off the walls. If they have food, sometimes my friends have to bring in food to the classroom to feed their students. And they've got 35 kids in
yeah.
the classroom.
Yeah.
And they're a taxi driver. They are the counselor. They take them home after school. You know the story.
I do know the story very well.
So talk about some of the conversations you're having with educators about these issues and how they should deal with young people, young black girls, for example, who act out because
yeah.
of what they're dealing
yeah.
with.
So, you know, I started my very first job was as a teacher. And I think most teachers, and I say this in the book, I really believe that most teachers enter the profession because they care and because they love children, understand the value of education, and they want to play a role in their successful development. That said, I think we're all living, as I said before, with implicit biases that inform how we engage other students. The conversations that I've had with educators so far have been very encouraging to me because, again, I think most people understand that what I'm describing is not made up, right? And for many of them, they want to do something better and they want to respond differently. They just don't know necessarily how to do it. They'll say in frustration that they don't have the tools to be mm-hmm. a counselor. They don't have the tools to, you know, respond to every child in crisis. At the same time, and I include some of these narratives in the book, there are teachers who say, well, today, given the construct of how we've shaped our learning environments, the teacher does have to teach more than the curriculum. I'm married to an educator who is the taxi driver, the coach, the counselor, the consultant, mm-hmm. you know. And I think it's important for all of us to understand that as we build out community, and one of the things that has always been successful in the learning of children is the practice of leading with and constructing classrooms that have been built on a foundation of love Anyone can do that. But if we build a foundation of a classroom culture, climate on punishment, then we're engaging differently. In the back of the book, I talk a bit about how to construct classrooms that I believe are most conducive to the healthy development of Black girls, and talk a bit about the things that Black girls themselves identify as being critical to their own education, but also what my research has found to be effective and or promising in the development of responses. And when I talk about this and when I look at it, I think it's important for us to explore a couple of things. One is how we develop healing-informed responses to problematic student behavior. And in that work, I think it's important to establish a continuum of responses to really, from the very beginning of developing the classroom climate and set of norms and expectations, is to talk to the students and co-construct how you're going to engage in the development of a safe learning environment and a safe space. Oftentimes, as educators, we'll enter the classroom and say, these are my rules, deal with it. Instead of saying, okay, what do you need to be present today, right? What do you need to be an effective learner? We don't often engage that question from the very beginning. I have found that when we do that, particularly with girls, with Black girls, they respond because they feel that you see them. Overwhelmingly, when the girls that I spoke with, I went directly to the girls who have been pushed out and talked to them about what would have kept them from that space. And they often respond with the same thing. I just want to know my teacher cares about me. I want to know that my teacher sees me. I want to know that he or she, most of the workforce is feminine, but, they'll say, I want to know that she understands who I am and doesn't just see me, as this loud girl, right, or this problematic, disruptive girl. And these are the things that I think are critical. Also, in developing healing-informed classrooms in schools, we've got to understand that for Black girls and for other girls of color, particularly those who are living with multiple oppressions, it's important for us to talk about student enrichment and group work and some of the effective ways of communication that allow for students to deeply interrogate subject matter. A lot of the girls who had been pushed out in the book and who talked about their own labeling or the way in which labeling by educators in their spaces prevented them from learning described situations where they might be asking a question for clarification, or they might be asking a question because they are critically engaging in the subject matter, and they were seen as being disruptive, called annoying, and their act of critical thinking was viewed as an affront to the authority of the educator. And again, that's when you have to step back and say, how are we reading the behaviors and engagement of young people? I know that I was actively engaged and encouraged to ask questions. And if I were not asking questions, it was taken as a sign of my lack of participation, right?
Right.
And so it's important for us to, again, understand what it is that we're trying to do and how we're trying to get this work across. And the other two areas that I think are critical for teachers to explore and schools, because it's not just about teachers. It's about, the school climate and educators and superintendents really cultivating responsive and de-biased learning. So, again, looking at the curriculum, a lot of the Black girls described engaging in material that they felt did not critically reflect them and their historical contributions, right, mm-hmm. to society, and they wanted more of that. Certainly, practices, training, and discussions about implicit bias, talking about intersectionality. I mean, these are concepts that our most rigorous schools are actively engaging in, and there is no reason why every school cannot be in that very same space in terms of understanding how multiple identities shape one's experience and how that plays a role in how they engage in academic material. And the last thing I want to say about that, or at least until we get into more questions, is about college and career pathways. Mm-hmm. Many young people want to know, all of us really wanted to know, what does this mean for me? But for children who are living in high poverty scenarios or who are at a crossroads of trying to understand whether they need to go make money or if they need to stay in school, they really have to understand the connection between what they're learning and what their career objectives and goals might be. And for those who don't have an idea, they need to know. One girl described, and I included this in the book, she wanted to know that she was learning real things mm-hmm. that would actually matter. She said, I don't want to get to college and discover that I've been, playing Little League this whole time, I think is how she framed it. And it's important because of the ways in which, again, our ideas about the possibility and ability of black girls to participate in the rigor, the academic rigor, is often informed by what we believe they'll do and what they'll be. And so in some cases, you know, educators thinking that they're doing the right thing are granting permission for these girls to fail when the girls want to just know that you believe in them and trust them enough to understand that they can elevate to a specific level to be their most competitive selves.
Monique Morris is author of the book Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Susan in Oakland. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I love this conversation. And Monique, you're just doing incredible work. I just want to thank you. You know, really, it's really moving. My question is about how me, just your average listener, could possibly help in this situation. I'm looking for a way to apply my volunteer skills in the Bay Area and, you know, what's possible. I get how much work there is for school administrators and teachers, et cetera, but what about the rest of us? Can we help?
That's a great question, and I appreciate your comment about the work because there was once a time when folks didn't quite get it, what I was doing. So, yes, I do think that there is a way for the general public to play a role in this. One of the things that I try to encourage people to do, no matter, you know, who you are or where you are situated, is to really begin to explore the question of how patriarchy and racial bias, impact where how we engage black girls, how we see them, right? And so I think there are a couple of things. Number one, I would encourage every listener to just spend some moment of reflection on how they have engaged black girls in their lives, how they see them in public, how they watch them, and how they come to understand what's happening. The second thing is, I think in terms of, you mentioned something critical that I want to actually pick up on and respond to, which is volunteer opportunities in schools. Many of our schools are woefully under-resourced. And I actually, one of my early jobs as a young adult was to facilitate a volunteer program in San Francisco schools. And so I think it's really important for us to look at ways of volunteering in schools to support academic achievement, to encourage active participation and discussions about how to support the learning of girls. But the other thing that I think we can all do is pay attention to some of the policy options that come before us. All of us play a role in how we come to understand school board discussions how, at the very local level, but also at the state level, really looking at supporting legislation that does expand the scope of response to children who get in trouble, and to really encourage legislators and each other to do less policing of bodies and do more engagement around preventative interventions that are going to build skill set among individuals so that there is less of a need to police anyone. So I think there is sort of a set of discussions that can still be had. But one of the most powerful things that I believe we can do as community members is continue to have conversations with each other to challenge the popular consciousness that facilitates the criminalization of our girls.
Thank you for calling in, Susan. It reminded me of a show we did about the education system in New Jersey. And in one class that had a lot of low-income kids who were acting out, they had one teacher and three or four assistants. Mm-hmm. And one little girl ended up in a shelter with her mom. She left an abusive partner. And one of the teachers decided that she was going to pick that little girl up, take her home, give her so much attention, and she flourished as much as she could under the given circumstance. But think about it. If there was one teacher in that class, who knows what would have happened to that girl?
Yeah, I did an evaluation of a program in the Bay Area that was very innovative, and they talked about sending text messages to girls to remind them to arrive on time, and they just had little things that show that you care. I wrote an academic piece about it called, a sacred inquiry, right? What does it mean to lead with love in these spaces? And often it just means recognizing that they're there, giving them the little extra, sort of support. And these are things that any of us can do. If you see someone, tell them, I see you in so many ways, right? Say, excuse me, are you okay today? How are you? Hi, right? Know people's names, say them correctly. Those kinds of things that are really important to many of our girls.
And that story was in The Prize by Dale Russikoff. We have an email from Karen who says, thank you for a fascinating discussion on a problem nobody discusses. I'm not black, I'm white, but I sure am a feminist, and this all resonates with me. She says, here's what just rocked me. Dr. Morris's rhyme, which, quote, everybody knows, I'm 70, I grew up in the Bay Area, I've never heard that rhyme in my life, I've never heard the term fruit cocktail in that sense. This rocked me because it emphasized, on a very personal level, the gap between black and white Americans, even between black and white female Americans, who are both to some degree put down by a patriarchal culture.
Yes. Yes. When I said everybody knows it, I was absolutely talking about black women and girls.
I'd never heard of it.
I know. And I could tell from your face. I know everyone else couldn't see your face. But when I say these things, that's what I mean, is that we have a common need to explore how various identities are impacted by the patriarchal structure that, you know, Karen is describing, right? And that we have been engaging in so many ways, absorbing, reinforcing. And we've got to interrupt it.
Well, we would love to have you back with a panel of black girls.
Yes.
To talk about this. Monique Morris is author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
On the next Your Call, we break down the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, checking facts, providing context, and taking your calls and emails. What did we learn about the candidates, about the news media, about this election, and our democracy? What was the most telling moment in the debate for you? Tweet your questions and your comments to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.